Discourse Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Essen, and I'm joined by my regular discoursers, Travis Hudson.
Who is trying to get his headphones to work.
And Andrew Riley.
My headphones are just fine, thanks.
And gentlemen, it has been far too long. We're going to hit the ground running with some timely topics. Travis, you are the person that I respect a lot because you have a healthy relationship with politics. And I'm curious, have you heard anything about any recent Supreme Court decisions?
And by healthy relationship, you mean I usually don't pay attention.
I think that's healthy.
Okay. I know, well, as my wife told me, they struck down affirmative action. And I said, I don't know if that's actually what it was, but it was along those lines. I don't want to steal your thunder from it, but I did have questions about exactly what the scope of the decision was.
All right. So, well, congratulations. You've chosen our topic for tonight because there were three Supreme Court cases, and I was wondering which ones you'd heard of. So, yes, you're referring to...
Well, there were many more than three, but there's three high-profile ones recently. Well,
yes. Thank you for the clarification. Yes, you're referring to, I think, Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard, which also had a... Obviously, I'm not a lawyer or anything like that, but there was also a companion case, I believe, that involved North Carolina. And it was about Harvard's admissions policies, where it was found that Asian Americans or Asian applicants had a much lower acceptance rate than black applicants who had the similar qualifications, testing scores and whatever else. And effectively, I mean, I think your wife was correct. It was effectively striking down affirmative action. And I'm curious what you think about that.
Well, okay. The reason I questioned was it really striking down affirmative action is because is the scope of this just for higher education admissions process? Does this strike it down for employers and everything else that affirmative action covered?
I believe this is narrowly tailored to, higher education admissions processes.
It's so narrowly tailored that it is public higher education, so public colleges, right. Private colleges that accept federal money, but specifically called out in the argument was not the military academies.
That was the other detail I knew was, the military academies, because the logic there was... they feel the military itself is diverse, so they want to guarantee diverse leadership of the military. Why we don't need diverse leadership of the rest of society, I guess that's not a fact they care about.
It may be a fact that they care about, but is college actually the path towards leadership? Now, there's certainly a strong correlation between your Ivy Leagues and being, say, a CEO. So this case being at an Ivy League school is very important. But we're all graduates of Virginia Tech. We love our alma mater. It really doesn't matter a whole lot that we went to Virginia Tech, especially since of what we variously majored in. We were there for an education, not for the connections. If you go to the Ivy Leagues, you're there for the connections. And the connections is important on the affirmative action side because those people who are receiving affirmative action, if it's still there and accepted, cannot get those connections through other means. That's not a path that they have available to them. But suddenly it is if they are admitted in. That's the power of affirmative action and why it seemed so important and why some people are very upset about it being taken away.
And to your point, like this is something that a lot of people are very upset about, but it also impacts a fairly small segment of the population, right? Like not everybody goes to college. A lot of people go to colleges which are not overly competitive, where and in fact, actually, prior to this, there were a number of states, surprisingly enough, that had already banned affirmative action, California being one of them. And so there were already a small subsection of people who this has affected. Yes, it's sometimes it's the more, prestigious and fancy named colleges like Harvard. But it's not something that's probably going to impact the average person's life.
And it doesn't have to impact business. Like, this is not going to suddenly make the Rooney Rule in the NFL, something you guys are quite familiar with, go away. This is the requirement that every head coaching position be have an interview with at least one African-American minority candidate. And so this is no guarantee that they get the position, but you have to at least interview them. And some people play this off and just, you know, fudge the rules. And other people are like, oh, hey, I never realized this guy was as good as he was. And then he actually gets a real shot that he wouldn't have had because the interview happened. That's the hope of the Rooney Rule. And it has had some success. There's a much higher percentage of African-American coaches in the NFL now than there were 20 or 30 years ago. The NFL does not have to change this. The corporate world does not have to change anything that they are doing, but they may choose to. They can say, you know what, the society has changed, and we're not going to get any blowback if we remove some of these policies that were pro-affirmative action. So we can give it to the people we wanted to give it to in the first place, our buddies. The cronyism wins out more than anything else, I would say, in these situations. Or they can just say, we want the person who's the best candidate no matter what, and that means these specific credentials, and it just turns out that minorities never have those credentials for all the various reasons you can come up with. And then they can move on that, and it will be just as legal as it ever has been. The question is, where does society go? The fact that society is upset with this ruling means that I think some of that concern over the public sector blowback is overdone, but it is a possibility, and that's one of the things that does come up as part of this discussion.
Well, I think. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Travis.
Oh, I was just gonna, well, I had several things to stack up, I guess. But I guess one thing to ask about that would be, like, one thing that I gather people usually have a problem with talking about affirmative action is they think about it like, right, it's a quota system where it's like, oh, well, because I didn't get in because that person got in and they only got in because of affirmative action, and like that's where the resentment really kind of comes in this process, right? And my naivete, was it actually like a quota system? Is that how you had to satisfy affirmative action, was saying like, yes, we, I know it was like percentage based though, whereas like
if quota systems had been previously struck down as unconstitutional, so okay, they had to, if they wanted to do affirmative action, do it in a way that was not a strict quota. They couldn't say we have 10 slots for African Americans here and we're going to pick out the 10 best African American students to put them in. They couldn't do that. They had to find a way to get the numbers that they wanted by playing with formulas and algorithms, and we've gotten very good at making sure the algorithms give us what we want. So the colleges were able to do that.
But at the same time, it is effectively a zero-sum game. I mean, I know a lot of times we'll talk about how, oh, you know, the economy is not a zero-sum game. It's not a fixed pie. Someone doesn't have to get poor for someone else to get richer. Well, in this case, when you have a fixed number of people that you're admitting to a college, it basically is a zero-sum game. If a lesser qualified affirmative action applicant gets in and over you, then you are kind of being harmed by this policy. It is kind of hard to get around the fact that it is, at its core, racial discrimination.
So what do you think about, I know one of the caveats they did leave in there was you can still write about your life experience in your essay. So is that just going to become, I guess, the twist to that would be, sure, you can go ahead and put it in there, but if there's nothing forcing them like there was affirmative action, then like, I guess you're just hoping that you're going to hit a college admissions officer that actually like feels your story and then preferences you over somebody else, right?
And I think Harvard actually, like the day of the ruling or maybe the day after, came out with like a statement saying like, basically thumbing their nose at it, saying like, we disagree with it and we saw that this is the loophole and we encourage applicants to tell us about their, you know, whatever, their difficult story. And the fact of the matter is, like, college admissions are already kind of unfair in a number of ways, especially at these elite institutions, right? A lot of people have brought up legacies, which are really
my
only...
My father went to Yale, so I get to go to Yale.
Yeah, it's really like just a blatant money grab, and it's not... I mean, I'm sure some of the people deserve to get in, but probably not a lot of them.
Or even, I guess this is maybe the argument that people made for affirmative action would be like, yeah, I mean, if you level the playing field like this, it is going to be who already has the credentials to get into the college, right? Like, who's already got all the extracurriculars and like, yeah, sure, writing an essay is all well and good, but, right? I mean, they're looking at more than just, I know they're looking at grades and all that, but like, it's, you know, who's already done a lot of the stuff that they want you to already be doing when you get to like an elite school like that, right? Like the debate clubs or whatever. I don't know. That's like probably a stereotypical example, but like, you know what I mean? Like who can be our lead crew guy or something like that?
Yeah. I mean, there's sports scholarships as well, but I mean, I feel like there's always ways, even with the top of the best of the best, there's still always ways of differentiating people. It doesn't have to be like, you know, we have all these people are completely equal and we'll just use race as a tiebreaker. Like, there were standardized test scores, which I think a lot of these institutions stopped using, maybe to make it a little bit iffier how they were implementing these diversity quotas, or not quotas, I guess, but, you know, these affirmative action programs. You know, you can see, like, their class ranking and stuff like that. Like, there's still ways of separating the cream of the crop from the cream of the crop, if you will.
The other thing that you're going to see here is not just that the colleges are going to try to maintain their status quo, because they have, at this point, a vested interest in maintaining the status quo. They don't want to turn away a student that they were going to accept last year, this year, just because the court has changed the ruling. They're going to try to find a way to make sure that things change as little as possible. They'll comply with the rule, but as you said, Travis, they're going to find that loophole and push on with it. But what this is going to do, getting back to the societal response to this, is it's going to have a chilling effect. California, as Paul mentioned, is one of the states that had eliminated affirmative action. And as soon as they did that, their institutes of higher education, pretty much all of the California public institutions, saw a marked decrease in the number of African-American students. Not because they weren't accepting them, but because they weren't applying. They had to do a tremendous outreach to try and get those numbers back up, and they've only now, like a decade later, finished to get it close to parity with where it had been before. It takes a tremendous amount of time and a tremendous amount of effort. And in honesty, I think that might be the best way to go about it anyway, rather than trying to pull in from the colleges to push up from the previous level, the high schools, wherever it is that they're coming from, to make sure that you're identifying them there, because these are the people who have the closest interaction with them in their existing state before they get to the place that's supposed to transform them or give them that opportunity.
And I guess that's what I was kind of clumsily saying earlier, is like, it would be, maybe it'd be better to put more resources, however you do that, down, further down, to like help the people that need the boost more. Like, right, if it's one thing to go to like the elite high school and like, oh well, like, okay, we're gonna just dump more money into your system and like help you get even more qualifications, versus like somehow that those resources, I won't even say money, but like the resources go to like another school and be like, hey, these kids like don't have any extracurriculars or something like that, let's like help them at that level. Like, why does it have to wait until college to become like this, where everybody gets equal opportunity at that point?
And it can help individuals who aren't even college bound. The difficulty is, as you're pointing out, that algorithms are cheap.
Well, and I guess that's the other question I had with affirmative action, was like, for something like Harvard, there's already kind of an automatic weeding out process of like, if you're not getting a scholarship, you've got to be rich basically to already bother applying to the school anyway. And that's already a huge, I don't know if it's a self-selection is the right term or not, right? But there's already like a selecting algorithm going on there of like, who's even rich enough to bother applying.
Right. And to your point about like, this impacts a very small number of people. And I wish I could find the data on this, but I remember reading it. Somebody made the point of, what's more important, that we let, like, you know, however many dozens or maybe even hundreds of African-Americans into Harvard, or that we look at, like, I think there was a certain segment of schools in Baltimore that, like, none of the people in eighth grade, like, could pass, like, the math exam or whatever. Like, there are large segments of the public school system across this country which are completely and utterly failing, like, the students. And, like, a lot of them are in majority minority like population centers, right? They're in the inner cities, the poor areas of these inner cities. And so is it going to be helpful to let the cream of the crop get a little bit more fair up there, or is it better to try and bring up the people who are really struggling and get them on a better floor?
And the point there is like, you're not really even making the cream of the crop, as you're putting like more fair, because by the time they're like, kind of your point you just said there, like, unfortunately, a lot of kids are already screwed by the time they're done with elementary school, right? They're just never going to catch up. They're never going to get to the point where they could even write the essay to apply to a school like Harvard. So, yeah, like,
your path is already
They've already been screwed. Mm-hmm. So why? That's kind of what I was trying to say earlier too. Was like, why not push more resources? Like, we put college on such a pedestal to begin with. because there's all these things about, oh, like if you have a college education, you're going to earn this much more of your career and all, you know, like there's like numbers to back up some stuff, but it's like, well, that's all well and good for the people that go to college. But like you guys have said multiple times, not everybody is college bound. For whatever reason, right? I mean, like,
probably too many people are college bound right now.
Too many people.
This college debt problem that we're going to talk about.
Oh my God, you guys are teaming me up for the transition to the student.
So like, yeah. So yeah. So if we want to move on to that, but I would say like, I guess I'll kind of end my point there. Is like, I would rather more focus and effort and resources was put lower down, like particular elementary school, and give these kids, teach them how to read, teach them how to do math, and like, lift people up, kind of, you said, push them up from the bottom. Let's not try to like keep, I don't know, pulling them from the top or whatever Andrew said earlier, maybe, or something like that.
Guys, we're agreeing too much. This is a problem.
Well, oh no, no division.
Let me throw out one more question then, before we transition. And I'm sorry, I just wasted the perfect transition there. But it has felt like in the past, I don't know, 4 or 5 years or whatever, there's been an increasing push about equity and like DEI programs and all this thing. And it has certainly felt like the culture has been going a certain way. And Andrew, I think you touched upon like the kind of the societal blowback to this ruling. I was surprised to see that there have been some opinion polls, and affirmative action is largely not very popular. People are actually in favor of this ruling and kind of see it as something that, across a lot of ethnic groups too, it's, you know, there's obviously some places there, some groups that are more in favor, some groups that are less, but it's a generally unpopular movement. And I'm curious where you people see the culture going right now. Cause
a question that I was expecting.
Travis and I have seen like our the high school that we've been to has been embroiled in a lot of controversy around like, this very thing, right? Like, we have too many Asians. We're going to implement some more equitable admissions process to allow other ethnic groups in. And it has seen, I think there's even a group called, like, you know, Parents for, you know, Fair Admissions or something, very similarly named. And I guess I'm curious, where is the culture going in this?
I'll start. Because it has some answers to a question that I thought you were going to ask a minute ago, and I'm going to
answer the question you thought I was going to ask.
Exactly. So I'm going to take that and turn it around and say where the culture is going to go is where they want it to be all along. People, especially Americans, want to believe in meritocracy. That if you're good, you'll be seen as good, successful, and rewarded for that with additional success and opportunities. And we don't have that in a lot of ways. And so this is a situation where, like, okay, we are not allowing a great opportunity for people who could be successful. So we want to encourage that. That's what affirmative action is in its best case, and we want that. But unfortunately, affirmative action tends to be the quota concept, like what Travis was talking about earlier. And people hate quotas. If you ask someone about quotas, it's going to be, you know, I think it's like 70% are like, yeah, this ruling is probably the right thing. We don't think affirmative action is the right choice. You talk about quotas, it goes up to 90%. Like even in the situation where you're accepting that some of this is not quota-based, there's still this level of unpopularity because we want people to succeed on their own merit, and it should be obvious. The fact that it's not is the problem, and we need to address that. And that's where people want to go, and that's where the complaint comes in. And, sure, some people are being hurt by this directly, and they're going to be unhappy with this, but that is not where the bulk of the concerns of the society are. Where the DEI, I think, is actually blowing back to society is on the concept of not just achievement and education, but acceptance and dignity. We have to say, this person on the other side of the conversation, who I don't necessarily have anything in common with, is still a human being and worthy of the respect that every human being has. We're really bad at that in society right now, and it doesn't have to be a racial thing. It turns out that it is also a racial thing, because there's this long history of especially whites, especially blacks. So we say, we enslaved you, and then we're going to treat you badly, we're going to Jim Crow the whole thing, and then we're still not going to acknowledge you as a full human being, even when everything else has worked out. We don't give you any opportunities because there's nothing for you, because you're not a person. And as long as that is the case, we will continue to be struggling. And so we have to get underneath that whole thing. Like I said, getting back to the whole basis of this thing, put the money at the low level, put the effort at the low level.
Well, and that's another reason why people would hate quotas so much, is because even on the people who are benefiting from it, because, I mean, I'm I'm pretty sure I've heard stories like they are then resented because, right, they're there and like they feel like people are looking at them like you don't. And I've heard this story on newscasts before, but like people will look at them and be like, you're only here because you were, you know, part of the quota or whatever. You don't actually belong here. Like my friend isn't here because he couldn't get in. You're here instead. And there's resentment. So I'm kind of not surprised from that perspective of like why the people you would expect to be pro, we keep saying quota, even though there wasn't a quota system, but like that was the perception of it, right? Could be on this, you know, against it kind of thing. Even if they're benefiting from it, they're like, well, we're benefiting from it, but we're still suffering under it.
And not just resentment, but there's also like, I think it's called the mismatch theory, right? Like, are you actually helping people by taking them for and accepting them into a school that they might not be the best match for? They might mm-hmm. be better off in the second best school or the third best school. And you, if you throw them into a situation where they feel woefully unprepared and just not ready to thrive, like maybe they'd be better off being in a better environment.
It also, I said, I know we're totally blowing past your transition point, Paul, but
it's totally my 110% my fault.
We talked about, I mentioned about we put college on a pedestal. Not only that, we put like specific colleges on an even higher pedestal on that pedestal, right? Like I would actually almost feel, I don't know what the right adjective it is, but like I guess I'd just feel kind of put out by, if I'm running like a community college, especially being like, we're here, we're right here, guys. Like, like we will give you a college education.
Yeah, you'll like, get a degree. You'll get skills, you'll get the job. Get connections. Maybe, will you get the job? This another college thing that came up in the courts a couple years ago, where you know you go to the for-profit community-like college, the Strayers. I don't want to say their name necessarily because this is not about Strayers specifically. They're probably a fine-paid college, but for private for pay low cost local colleges that would give you a degree and a promise that the education that they gave you would give you a better chance of getting a job, and it turns out it didn't,
because I guess I wasn't thinking about those like legit, well, what I would call legit community colleges. But and I also said they would get you, I did say they would get you a job, not they would not get you the job, right? that maybe you want, like you're going to be able to get, you're going to hopefully be able to work at somewhere besides fast food or retail if you come out with any sort of college degree.
Well,
but so, you might not be able to pay that college degree back, right, Paul?
Yes, exactly. Thank you. Thank you for that transition there. We could talk, obviously we could talk about this all day, but Biden versus Nebraska. I need your guys' help because I don't understand. No one has been able to explain to me what the rationale is for forgiving a crap ton of student debt to people who are going to be largely more affluent in society, not fixing the underlying problem at all, and doing it via like executive order and completely bypassing Congress when it's got a $400 billion price tag. Please help it make sense.
So I have a feeling, unfortunately, to Andrew's point, we're going to agree too much here. But I mean, I think every point you just made is what I was talking to my wife. So I actually did know about this case.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know about it. I forgot about it by name. But yeah, I think I specifically said, I was like, A bunch of us already paid off our student loans.
So oh, that's screw you. Line, yeah.
B, there's going to be more people getting new student loans that you're not going to forgive in the future. So you're helping a very select group of people right now that, I'm sorry, I know there are people that like got suckered into school and like didn't know what they're getting into. But like, sorry, boohoo, cry me a river. Like, I mean, you were a consenting adult by the time you signed on that paper to go to the college. Like,
probably.
Probably. No, but by the legal definition, you were, well, maybe
they could be 17 still.
And yeah, okay.
And you have an early entry
when you're accepting your college. Yes, okay.
Yeah, so but the gist is like if you do, my brother-in-law went into college and I spent a long time. I was like, you want to go to this college and you want this tuition? All right, you're going to take out these loans. It's good. I showed him the math. He's like, yeah, this is what I want to do. All right, okay. I can't stop him. Right, he's going to do this thing. It's a bad choice. And he's living with those consequences. He's one of those guys who's got a lot of this student loan debt that probably would be benefiting from this, and I don't think he's in favor of it. Now, a lot of folks who would be getting the money wouldn't be in favor because, hey, I'll take $10,000. Thank you very much. But, yeah, obviously the general way that this is done was horrible. Why did it happen? What's the rationale? It was a campaign promise. He is playing to his base. These people all voted for him, not just because they were voting against Trump, but because he was promising them a thing. This is a problem that the Democrats have had, especially recently. Do you remember, this is a little bit off topic, but I'm going to go quick. Raphael Warnock was going for his first re-election thing. The
Georgia
the,
Senate.
He went to the Georgia
Thank
Senate.
Thank you.
Yes. So he's being elected to the Georgia Senate, or he was eventually elected to the Georgia Senate. Runoff, that's what. He couldn't win in the primary, the first race, because it was too close. He didn't get 50+%. Somebody
Thank
else
you,
was in the race.
Libertarian candidate.
Just shave off that like 0.5%. That's all you need. So they have to go to the runoff. And during the runoff, President-elect Biden is like, we're going to get Raphael Warnock elected so he can give you another $2,000 of Biden money. And then they
Biden
didn't.
Bucks.
Because it was like, we need more stimulus. This was back in the stimulus period. Like, we'll go give it 2,000 more bucks, guys. Come on, get Raphael Warnock in there, into the Senate, so you can pass my bill and you can get that cash. He promised the money. He's promising
bribery?
Them money to mm-hmm. get their votes. And it works.
I mean, okay. Isn't that how, like, most politicians work, to be honest?
Yes, but
it's not that blatant.
How explicit this was yeah. remarkable.
But yeah, like, and Paul, when you introduced this topic, you hit it on the head. It's like, you're not fixing the underlying problem. Like,
well,
this is fixing one, like, set of people's problems. You're not lowering the cost. Like, there's just going to be a whole other generation of people that rack up the same debt because they're just as erstwhile or whatever. And, like, are they going to get it forgiven? Like, that's going to be the expectation going forward, right? Is like, now they're like,
well, exactly, yeah.
I mean, that's why Social Security never goes away, right? I mean, like, you're like, wait, I paid for them. You got to give me my money. So now you got to pay. Like, it never goes away. Like, once you've started this, you're opening Pandora's box.
I think it's going to be even worse than not fixing your problem. I think you've made the problem worse. Because
now colleges can charge more.
Well, because right now you're like, oh, shit, like, this is a lot of money. Like, you might actually think about it twice before you sign on that dotted line. And colleges will be like, yeah, this is a lot of money. And people are, like, thinking twice about it. If you have this student loan forgiveness, then all of a sudden people are going to be far more likely to take out those big loans because they're like, hey, I might get this all wiped away later. And colleges will be like, look at that. People are far more likely to pay the big bucks because it might get wiped out. We can jack up prices even more. So I would argue that, like, not only are you not solving the underlying problem, you're probably going to make it even worse.
And obviously, the solution here is that they have to make higher education free, just like K-12 is free. Don't you understand, Paul?
There you go.
And aren't a lot of loans, people get federal loans? So this is the government paying off its own loans?
Well,
is
so that's part of the argument about how,
yeah,
like, oh, this doesn't hurt anybody.
To start with.
Yeah, like,
yes, it does.
But the argument, like, I agree it's wrong, is that, like, oh, this doesn't hurt anybody. This is just the Department of Education owns all these loans. They'll just wipe the debt clean. That's fine. Well, except, like, you're adding $400 billion to the deficit.
Well, no, my joking was, like, aren't you doubling the debt that the government already paid out the money, and now they're like, now we're going to pay our own debt. That's not how it works, right?
You're adding that much to the debt. And this yeah. started, like, the very first iteration was that this would be done on all different types of loans, not just the federal loans. And then you actually had, like, the people who own the loans genuinely withstanding. The most important thing about this case is whether or not they had standing, which is where I expected this to go. If it made it to this point, which is that the court is deciding on the merits of the case, it was 110% obvious that this was going against the Biden administration. The only hope they had was that they would say, you know what, Nebraska, you haven't been harmed by this. It's not your money. It never was your money. It's a stupid thing, and we can all agree about that. If we get if someone who has standing could come in here, like if Republican senator from your state, not the state, came and made this thing, because he was the one who was supposed to, shouldn't even be the senator, should be the representatives. If the collection of representatives came and made this case, we'd be hearing it. But you cannot bring this case because you're not the one hurt.
So just because I only learned about that word you just said earlier,
standing?
Like earlier this week, standing. I pretty much learned what that word was this week. Yeah, it's like the plaintiff in a case has to be able to show that they were personally harmed, right?
Right. Or that they have. So this is where we're maybe getting to the third case. But
yeah, I was going to say this is a perfect transition. I have another question though.
All right, we'll put it on that. We'll put standing on pause. We'll come back to it. Let's continue.
Okay, maybe I'm thinking of a different case. Sorry.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let me just make one quick comment, and then you can talk about standing, and then we can move on. The only thing I wanted to say is, I think it's ironic that the student, because right now the student loan repayments have been paused for, I don't know, a couple years now since COVID, right? There's a strong argument to be made that has contributed to inflation, because instead of all these people paying off their debt, they've had a lot more money in their pocket. What are they going to do with that money? go out and
buy
goods.
It was supposed to be inflationary. The whole point was that these people needed to have access to money to buy the things that they need because they weren't working anymore, because the economy was collapsing because the government was saying lockdown.
Okay, so we all agree, okay. Biden versus Nebraska. Sorry, Travis.
Well, no, I was just going to joke then, like, why, what, you know, by that same logic, like, why weren't their car payments suspended? Why wasn't their mortgage payments suspended? Like, I mean, like,
exactly.
Right? Why,
credit card payments.
One thing?
Yeah.
Like, it's something that the federal government had a lot of more direct control over. And because they're the ones receiving the money in through an intermediary, and it is going into their coffers, and they have a lot of way, way more control over it, which is one of the reasons why the prices keep going up, as we will probably discuss at some later point. These are very standard libertarian-esque positions. We will fill you in at any point if you have questions. Please feel free to ask questions.
Anyway, it felt like we agreed too much on that topic.
We do so agree too much.
We agree too much, but I would just say there are far more, like, regressive? Now I got my terms off. So the student loan benefits to affluent people. There's so many other options you could have picked, which have been like benefiting poorer people, right? Like credit card bills. You couldn't.
I was going to say credit card debt. For credit card debt, that's who needs the help.
Anyway, Andrew, explain to us standing.
Medical debt would be an even better.
Oh,
one.
Yeah, medical debt. Yeah, there you go. Andrew, explain to us standing and why the website designer in Colorado never had it.
I thought the standing argument was about was what Andrew was talking about.
Well, it's related. It's because every case needs to have standing, Biden plan was, you know, private people who made investments into student loan. You are going to take a haircut so these people can get, and the private investors are like, excuse me, what? And they sued, and then immediately got decided, like, very fast. And Biden's like, oh, yeah, no, we can't do that. I meant the federal loans and the Pell Grants. We're fine with that, was a little more controllable.
So I think this last case that Paul just kind of alluded to, I didn't realize that was a Supreme Court case.
Another Supreme Court case, yes. So in this particular case, I forget the plaintiff's name, but she
303 LLC v.
Wait, is this the one where the plaintiff was made up?
Yes. We're going to get to that. No, not the plaintiff, but...
The defendant? Somebody was made up.
She is the plaintiff. The complaint against her was made up.
Okay. I knew something was fabricated. Or at least they claimed it was fabricated.
It's completely made up. Okay. I'll go out and say that as a fact, not knowing all the details. I'm like, no, it's pretty clear. So she is a friend of the baker from the Baker case a couple of years ago. You may remember the Baker case where the baker refused to bake specific cakes commemorating the same-sex wedding of a couple in Colorado. It's the same town, they're friends, and she is thinking of starting a new business where she's going to use her creative web design skills to build websites for couples who are getting married. And she's thinking, you know what, my friend got hammered by the courts on this one. I could be too if I refused to do this. What would happen if that... And gets involved with one of these committees of lawyers that act out on these things and try to get cases in front of the Supreme Court. And they say, you know what, you've got an interesting point there. Because even though you haven't been harmed yet, you could be harmed by this law. And it's causing you to hesitate on starting this business, which is a harm. So this is where we can get your standing. And to sort of reinforce it, somebody wrote a letter indicating that, you know, if she did this, that they would be finding her to be not serving their very reasonable needs that they had every right to have and would sue her.
Somebody from the state of Colorado, correct?
From the state of Colorado, a lawyer, I think. This is like some official letter from a lawyer representing his client who was like, if this is where you're going to go, you know that we're ready to sue you, kind of thing. And so this works its way up. That particular piece of evidence is highly, highly suspect. But it is not necessary that it was genuine for her to have had standing, because this is now a citizen against her state. Like, if this is 303 against Colorado, which then gets turned into Colorado versus her and the appeal, then she can say, your law is hurting me, based on what I was saying initially, that she could have created the business otherwise, but it's created this hostile environment, so hostile that she just knows that if she does this in accordance with her mindset, her beliefs, that she will be sued, and this is going to cause her not be able to create a business, which means she's lost out on profits. She has to move out of the state if she wants to do this. This is a tough thing, and so the standing is awkward, because usually they really want strict standing, especially by the time you get to the Supreme Court. This has all been worked out in the lower courts over and over again, And it's really clear. This one was rushed because they wanted a more expansive ruling. When the Baker case in Colorado was ruled on, I want to say 4 or 5 years ago, it was a very narrow ruling. It was in favor of the Baker, but it was so narrow that it didn't actually address any of the things. It's like, no, yeah, Kennedy, very, very pro-gay rights, wrote the opinion, but it's like, you know what? We've had a lot of progress on gay rights, and not everyone is ready for it yet, and losers get to complain. This is one of his big premises in legal concepts. He says, if you lost a case, you at least get to complain about it. I'm not going to force you to come along right away. Unfortunately, for this particular situation, it means we go this way. Now, I think this is ultimately probably the best legal reasoning that we have on it. Like, look, you can't force someone to do this because on the free speech grounds, which is what they decided it on, this is pretty clearly something we wouldn't want. Like, if we had a very different situation, she's a web designer, and the local neo-Nazi party comes and says, hey, we want a website for us. It has nothing to do with marriage, but we want our website. You do good websites. Build this website. And she says, no, I'm not building a Nazi website. Seems pretty reasonable. But the ability to refuse customers for any business has been very problematic since the civil rights movement for good reasons, but it's a little bit messy.
Well, and that kind of came up a little bit during, because there were some jokes during COVID about how like businesses would mandate masks in their stores, and like free speech people would be like, no, I don't have to wear a mask in your freaking store. And I'd be like, I always thought it was like, it's technically private property. Yes, you have to follow the rules of the person that owns a private property, right? Like, is that
if the business can say no shirt, thing? No shoes, no service, they can say no mask, no service.
Right. So, like, and that was a joke that there was a comic strip that said that, like, they're really not going to like the no pants, no service policy that this store has or whatever. Like, once they see that, but so, like, is it kind of similar logic of that, or like, if you're allowed to dictate. Or like, you know, fancy restaurants require you to wear a suit and a tie, right? Mm-hmm. Type of thing. It's the same. It's kind of the same logic, right? Like, you're a private business. You're allowed to kind of select your clientele, right?
You're not supposed to, though. Under the law, they are supposed to serve everyone. But there have been plenty of carve-outs. But like, yeah, no, you know, even though we didn't mean everyone. We meant everyone with money. We meant everyone that was dressed.
I don't know if Paul's trying to say something or not. He's just nodding.
No, not really. I mean, I honestly don't. I think we've covered most of the stuff. I don't really have much
sorry,
else to add
I
here.
Sorry, I rambled it.
No, it was good. I don't think. I think a lot of the problems that I've seen with the coverage of this has been like it's like a rollback of like, you know, LGBT rights or whatever. Like, and it's I so understand. Sorry, go ahead, Travis.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to actually interrupt you, but I was going to ask the naive question. What was the actual ruling in this case?
Well, they ruled in favor of free speech.
So
What does that mean?
In theory, this hypothetical person was going to be asked to design a website for a gay wedding. Right. And this person was going to say no. And can they say no to creating a website for a gay wedding?
Did they rule in favor of the person being able to say no?
And the Supreme Court said that you can choose not to. If your type of work involves some type of expression, like website design, or like a tattoo artist whatever.
So like, car dealer can't refuse to sell you a car just because they don't agree with you, because it's not a creative expression. Okay.
Right. Yeah. I can't refuse to serve you at a restaurant because you're black. I can't refuse to serve you to let you buy a car because you're disabled. None of those things apply.
Okay.
Or the website, I mean, the website designer, correct me if I'm wrong, they can't refuse to make a website for somebody just because they're gay. But they can refuse to make a gay marriage website or...
I actually think that is untested. Okay. I will say you're correct, certainly, that she doesn't have to create the website specifically for the wedding, which is what she was talking about doing. Her creativity cannot be compelled into the form that she disagrees with. Whatever it is that she's doing... So they come in and it's like, we want to have a gay pride website could also be just as problematic for her for the same reasons. Now, she said that wasn't her point. She just wasn't going to go down the gay marriage path. But the ruling opens up that opportunity for that to be a later case. Like, this was still relatively narrow because, you know, to this specific case, but there will be additional cases like this in the future.
And sorry, I guess I was kind of chuckling at Paul's, because I know you were trying to make a legit point, but however you phrased it, like, kind of sounded very semantics-y, but you were like...
I mean, it kind of is. It's like...
What was the distinction you said?
So, if I'm a gay person, and I go to you, you're a website designer, and I say, I want you to design me a personal website for myself, or, I don't know, any kind of website.
Okay.
You cannot say, like, no, I don't want to serve you because you're gay.
Okay. That would still be problematic as long as the website was like, I am a streamer and I want a website for my streaming services, right. Mm-hmm. And I happen to be gay and I'm refused service.
But huge problem. If I come up and say, like, hey, I want you to create a website, like a pride website that like has a picture of me and my husband kissing and like, I don't know. Just like,
I want you to, I'm a drag performer. I want
yeah,
you to
drag performer. My website
to make bookings or something.
And right. I, you know,
that's an area where it could get messy.
And the more obvious one would be like if the Westboro, you know, Baptist Church came up and said like, hey, I want this gay website designer to make my webpage, then obviously they should be allowed to say no.
Or with Andrew's the Nazi
yeah.
example.
We had Nazi
example. Jewish, like, yeah. I mean, I was also like, I mean, we talked about it, not on a podcast, but we talked about the, you know, the after school satanic club comes calling and like, hey, we want you to make a website, Catholic web designer. And the Catholic web designer could be like, yeah, no.
Now they can, but they can say no, but they don't have to say no.
Yeah, they don't have to say no. But also, to your guys' point, if this satanic club comes and says like, hey, we want you to make like this totally unrelated to Satan website, then sounds like they still have to.
Go ahead.
Well, and this seems like a catch-22 for like any service. It's like, especially the creative service. I can see the differentiation of like a service, like, blah, whatever, that was badly phrased, of like a restaurant or a car dealer or something like that. But it does seem like any creative endeavor is sort of like
some speech.
Well, and like there's also,
aren't there my other cuisine website is designers speech. Like we're back, well, like, to this, like, I can't serve black people, the black people don't understand my food.
But it also feels like, as if you were a gay person, would you want to go to the web designer that is known to be anti-gay? Wouldn't you just go to another website designer who's going to be more friendly to you? Because like,
did you just almost say web dyke?
I don't think so.
Just like the first case, like this is something that actually has a very narrow, like, how many people are affected by this? Who actually wants to go to the homophobic website designer and be like, hey, design my gay wedding?
And you don't even know if they're homophobic necessarily, but like in your first interaction, if you can tell, you might, wouldn't you just rather be like, well, yeah, I'm gonna take my business elsewhere.
If they say right? No, I don't want to, then why would you say like, fuck that, you have to. I'm going to sue you to make you make the website. Like, no. Like, why would you want to do that?
Just, we must have a different mentality. And, like, some of this is, like, people want to manufacture.
Yeah.
Sounds kind of cynical. They kind of want to manufacture cases to, like,
to fight the culture war.
Yeah.
There's a huge part of that. This is manufacturing cases. But there is a real case, where a situation where I'm a homosexual man with my homosexual partner. We're going to go get married. We're going to the... I don't know anything about this person. They say no. I've been harmed because there is at least some emotional distress. I have to go take time out to find some other service that may not be as high quality. This is the best web designer in the area. We thought this was going to be perfect for us. So it's not just that I want to make this person do it, because I don't. That bridge is burned. You can't make that person do it. That's very clear. They're going to do it. They'll do a shitty job.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Like, you're going to get a bad product, right?
So we'll go to the other guy. We'll do that. But that has caused me harm. So I can sue you now. Because you have harmed me. You've wasted my time. You've cost me money. And this is against the law. So now I get to sue you for damages that is on top of the fact that recompense for the fact that I'm going with this other person that gives me a less quality product.
So it sounds like we all disagree. Sounds like we all agree way too much again.
No.
No. All right, Andrew, tell us why we're wrong.
Just quickly, Neil Gorsuch wrote this opinion, and he wrote it incredibly narrowly. So a lot of these things that we've been talking about, the penumbra of this case, were not discussed. He's like, there are a lot of thorny issues in this one. This is what I'm saying. And it was like laser focused on this case. Like, in this particular case, this web designer with this concern doesn't have to. Everything else we've been talking about specifically in that environment, that's why I'm saying that situation that Paul addressed was untested, has not come up, is not discussed, is not decided. there will be more cases.
All right. So I have one last parting, I guess, question, maybe topic, and we can hit this quickly, hopefully. We've talked a lot about Supreme Court cases here. I think there's been a lot of talk about the Supreme Court as of late. Some of these issues have been around, like, executive actions in terms of the student loan forgiveness. When was the last time you guys can recall a major thing that Congress did that has reverberated throughout the culture?
I'm sure there's examples. I just don't follow it close enough.
And so the Build Back Better bill was pretty big. I mean, we haven't seen all the effects from it yet, but that was a big effect. And that was actually fairly recent.
The Build Back
Better.
Inflation
reduction. Wasn't that the Inflation Reduction Act?
The Inflation Reduction Act, yeah, is what ended up being called.
Wait.
Because that's what Manchin would sign on to.
Was that seriously IRA? I just realized it was IRA.
It's going to blow up our economy.
Yeah, that...
But that was, like, largely designed and pushed by the Biden administration, right?
Well, that's what the presidents always do. They have the bully pulpit for a reason. Like, this is the biggest problem that I have with the executive overall, which is one of the reasons why, back in 2016, I'm somewhat ashamed to say it at this point, but I've said it to you guys before, so I'll say it again, is that I had hope with Trump being president that the Congress would be like, well, this is not okay, and roll back those permissions that they had delegated to the executive and say, no, that those things that the Constitution says we're going to do, we are actually going to do, because we need to constrain your power, sir. You are a threat to democracy, which he proved to be. But no, they said, no, if I don't agree with you, I'm quitting Congress. I'm going to get run out on the primary. And then they all kowtowed to him. And so the executive remains as strong as ever because no one in Congress has the backbone to stand up to it after they've given him all the power.
This is where one of my constitutional-based friends would also push back and say, like, Congress shouldn't have as much power as it has either, right? Far more of it should be down at the state level because there's not, right? If you go by the Constitution, right, anything that's not in the...
Ninth and Tenth Amendments, there, good stuff.
Yeah, or in any of the amendments, although the amendments can be thorny because they...
The Tenth Amendment is very clear. Anything not specifically given to the federal government is held by the states.
Right, but, like, then
up until
can,
the
like,
Civil
make
War.
Then you can make amendments to start giving yourself more power, right? Just like the president has executive, I shouldn't say the president maybe, but the executive has accumulated more power over the course of time, right?
We became much more federalized and much more centralized, and a large part of that has to do with how the Civil War ended up.
I mean, the Constitution is also very clear that, like, Congress writes the laws, makes the laws, they hold the purse strings and everything, and that's something that has become increasingly less and less seemingly the case. I mean, this is my evergreen point, is that, like, Congress has just completely abdicated its responsibility for creating budgets and doing anything helpful other than just
doing
what the president
the budget,
wants.
What are they doing?
Nothing. This is the problem.
Who creates the budget? All I ever hear about is, like, these last minute
back, the House creates the budget.
Back dealings. Okay. The House creates it.
And if Justin Amash is to be believed, I don't think Congress has actually passed a budget in, like, over a decade or something.
Continuing resolutions and amendments to continuing resolutions.
That's why we have these budget crises all the time, because...
Which, just to point out, the most recent thing was not a budget crisis. It was a debt limit ceiling crisis.
Yeah.
We have a budget crisis that would have come up in September, but because they did the debt limit deal, part of the debt limit deal was a continuing resolution, essentially. So we won't have that particular thing in September.
I know we're going to run up on time soon, but I could ask... probably more questions about the debt ceiling thing too, but
please don't.
Yeah, I don't want to open up that
it's
right
painful
now.
All right, well, that seems like as that's painful seems like as good a place to end as any.
It's politics, it's always painful.
Yeah,
hopefully we're watching it, we're paying attention to it, and we are made dumber for it.
I mean, so I, you know, I started this off by saying, and maybe this is a good place to end on, like, you know, that I want to go to Travis because I felt like he had a healthy relationship with politics. Like, we had a brief discussion beforehand, like, I'm gradually coming around to the idea, like, this kind of maybe stoic idea of, like, not worrying so much about things you can't control. And in my old age, because, yes, I am old, and that's another thing we talked about, I'm becoming more and more aware of how little I control and could possibly control in politics. And ergo, why should I be so worked up and worried about it?
It is, well...
And we will get the government that we deserve, whether we want it or not.
And you will have people coming at you shaking your fist, like, you can't, like, because they'll take your, what you just said is like saying, like, you just, like, stopped caring about everything. But I would
we still vote.
Push back. Mm-hmm. Well, I would also push back with, like, the, you can control anything, but you can't control everything. Like, you have to focus your efforts onto, like, what matters most to you. And, like, that's what people do, and those are the causes. But then, like, when there's enough of those going on around you that particularly against you, it feels like, oh my God, the world, you know, the sky is falling at this point. Well, it's like, those people were on the other side of the issue, and they cared, I guess they cared, quote unquote, more than you did to go push on that issue. If you cared about that issue enough, maybe you should have been out there pushing the issue on your side as much.
And you say we still vote, Andrew, and you're correct. I do vote, but it certainly doesn't endear me to those people. When I have my, like, every 4 years post about, like, hey, everybody, you don't actually have to vote. Like, or at least you don't have to vote for the major party candidates.
Oh, yeah.
That pisses off people more than, like, anything else that I write.
My wife gets so mad at you every 4 years when you say, like, you don't have to vote. Or when you're out there,
your vote doesn't really matter.
Yeah, when you're out there, like, the aliens on Simpsons, like, go ahead, throw your vote away.
A local election in my state Senate district was decided by 4 votes.
Guess what? Your vote still didn't matter.
I didn't even vote in that election. I voted on the other party.
I demand a recount. I demand a recount.
All right, so everyone's mad at me, and hopefully
you right where we ought to be.
Yeah, had fun. Hopefully you enjoy this. We're back, baby. Can't stop the discourse.